This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءَ مَسَّتْهُ لن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذي صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: U.S. President Donald Trump faces another setback as the states of Wisconsin and Arizona certify Joe Biden as the winner of the presidential vote. The U.S. President's special advisor on the coronavirus resigns amid deep divisions among members of Trump's COVID-19 task force. And a group of arms control and rights organizations oppose planned U.S. arms sales to the UAE due to its role in Yemen and Libya. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. The U.S. states of Arizona and Wisconsin have certified the victory of Joe Biden in the November 3rd presidential election. In a statement, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers said that he signed a certificate of assertion for Biden and his running mate Kamala Harris. Arizona Secretary of State Katie Hobbs also finalized Biden as the winner after a recount. She also slammed all baseless allegations against the country's voting process. The certifications are yet another blow to President Donald Trump, who has refused to concede the election, claiming the vote was rigged in favor of his Democratic rival. Trump's campaign has also requested a new recount in Georgia, which is due to end on December 2nd. Several states have already certified Biden's victory. We were earlier joined by Colin Campbell, our Washington, D.C. correspondent. He says despite the results of Arizona and Wisconsin, Trump will not concede defeat anytime soon.
And who we know is fed a lot by his ego and just what he can get out of a deal, what he could get out of a certain situation. And right now, he's still getting the adulation and the attention from his supporters. We have to remember that even though the president lost the election in the Electoral College and in the popular vote, he still had more than 70 million Americans who voted for him. And he's trying to leverage this amount of Americans, these votes, into something for the future, whether it's a run in 2024, which has been speculated, or whether it's a television network where he would have some devoted fans, or if there was some other type of lucrative financial deal that he could get by keeping alliances with some of the Republicans in Congress. That's what he intends to do. And at the very least, he wants to try to overturn this election, right? If possible, if he could see that there's a way around it. But, like you said before, with the two states certifying their votes, two swing states, two major battleground states, Arizona and Wisconsin, it really seals the fate of the president trying to overturn the election. That doesn't mean that he's still going to stop trying.
The U.S. Senate remains divided on an aid plan for the pandemic-hit economy ahead of a year-end deadline. Lawmakers have urged their Senate colleagues to reach a deal as time is running out. Both Republicans and Democrats in the Senate have acknowledged the urgency of clinching a deal, but they remain divided on how much to spend and what to spend on. The deadlock comes despite months of negotiations. Both sides blame each other for the situation. The U.S. Congress in March approved a $2.2 trillion aid package, but a number of key provisions were expired at the end of the year. U.S. President Donald Trump's coronavirus pandemic advisor Scott Atlas has resigned after downplaying the threat of the disease for months. In his resignation letter obtained by media, Atlas thanked Donald Trump for the honor while wishing the next president the best. Atlas was selected by Trump to advise him on the pandemic, despite having no expertise in infectious diseases or epidemiology. He joined the White House this summer, where he clashed with top scientists and health experts, including Dr. Anthony Fauci. He was accused of providing Trump with incorrect COVID-related information. He was also at the heart of controversy over his comments against mask wearing. So far, the U.S. is the worst-hit country by the pandemic, with nearly 13.5 million infections and almost 268,000 deaths. Dozens of arms control and human rights organizations have denounced the U.S. plan to sell multi-billion dollars worth of arms to the United Arab Emirates. In a letter to the U.S. State Department and Congress, 29 advocacy groups warned that arming the UAE would cause more humanitarian crisis as the country is a party to the conflicts in Yemen and Libya. Earlier this month, the administration of President Donald Trump announced the approval of $23 billion arms sales, including F-35 fighter jets and missiles and drones to the UAE. The announcement comes on the heels of a U.S. brokered normalization deal between the UAE and the Israeli regime back in September. Political commentator Amidia Benjamin believes that the U.S. plan to sell weapons to the United Arab Emirates will fuel a brewing arms race in West Asia.
I feel that this is another escalation of the arms race in the Middle East. You sell these very advanced weapons to the Emirates, then Israel says, well, we need more sophisticated weapons because the U.S. is obligated to make sure that Israel always has the qualitative military edge. And we also feel that the Emirates has been involved in the war in Yemen, in the wars in Libya, and there's U.S. laws that says we're not supposed to sell weapons to countries that violate human rights or prohibit the entry of humanitarian goods. And this has been the case with the war in Yemen. So we are very much opposed to it, as we're opposed to just an escalation of weapons in the Middle East when we should be doing just the opposite. And it's ridiculous to call the UAE-Israel agreement a peace plan when it really is a weapons deal. And we know that the Trump administration is trying to push this through in its final months, but we're hoping that we can drag it out into the next administration and stop the sales from going through.
The European Union has condemned the assassination of top Iranian scientists. Brussels says that the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was a criminal act, but has urged all sides to practice restraint as tensions between Iran, the U.S. and Israel escalate once again. Bianca Rahimi has more.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was laid to rest. He was assassinated on Friday near the capital, Tehran. Iran has vowed to avenge the killing. On the day of the attack, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif urged the international community, especially the European Union, to abandon its shameful double standard and condemn this, quote, act of state terror. The European Union made its position clear in an official post on its website Saturday. This is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights the EU stands for. The EU is calling for all sides to practice restraint, though, saying this is a sensitive time. Germany has urged all sides not to allow the last weeks of Donald Trump's presidency in the US to obliterate hopes for fresh negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. The United Kingdom, however, has been less inclined to condemn the attack.
Well, look, we are concerned about the situation in Iran and the wider region. We do want to see de-escalation of tensions, and obviously, particularly, we want to try and find a route through on the nuclear dossier. I met with my E3 colleagues, so France and Germany, in Berlin this week. That kind of, it's a good example, that kind of cooperation, notwithstanding all the Brexit process, keeps going on. We're still waiting to see the full facts, trying to ascertain the full facts of what's happened in Iran, but I would say that we stick to the rule of international humanitarian law, which is very clear against targeting civilians.
Israel's lobby in the UK is strong, and British politicians are very careful not to offend the Zionist regime. The New York Times says Israel was behind the attack, citing an American official and two intelligence sources. Tel Aviv has carried out a number of assassination operations against Iranian nuclear scientists over the past decade. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu mentioned Dr. Fakhrizadeh by name in one of his presentations in 2018.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name.
U.S. President Donald Trump, who withdrew the U.S. from the landmark Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and has imposed new sanctions on Iran since, has only a few weeks left in the White House. There are indications his successor, Joe Biden, may have a different approach to diplomacy in the region and might go as far as rejoining the Iran nuclear deal and lifting some economic sanctions. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iran's envoy to the Vienna-based international organizations has called on the International Atomic Energy Agency to strongly condemn the assassination of a nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Qasem Ghaib-Abadi said the IAEA has a dire responsibility to in relation to member states that are receiving the agency's highest level of inspection and having the most transparent nuclear program. He added, despite his country's commitments, Iranian scientists are assassinated, they are under threat of assassination, and nuclear facilities are sabotaged. Ghaib-Abadi made these remarks after head of the UN nuclear watchdog said no one, including Iran, would benefit from decreasing or limiting his cooperation with the agency. He also added that so far the IAEA has not received any signals from Iran that anything would change regarding inspections of nuclear facilities. In Cuba, Venezuela, and Iran, concerns over the impact of unilateral sanctions in light of the COVID-19 pandemic are growing. At a UN seminar in Vienna, Iran's ambassador said banking restrictions have prevented the Islamic Republic from obtaining medicine and medical equipment to fight the coronavirus pandemic. Homa Lizki reports.
Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela host a virtual seminar at the UN headquarters in Vienna on unilateral sanctions and their impacts in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. The three countries are under crippling US sanctions that have added extra pressure as they struggle to fight the coronavirus. Banking restrictions resulting from the sanctions are affecting the country's ability to obtain medical equipment, a point highlighted by the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Iran's ambassador to international organizations in Vienna, Kazem Gharibabadi, said as the world's biggest imposer of unilateral sanctions, the US should be held accountable for the consequences of its actions.
These sanctions violate human rights in the current circumstances. In our country, we also face a problem in importing medicine and medical equipment from abroad as a result of these cruel, unilateral, coercive measures and banking restrictions. Those who impose these sanctions have international responsibilities.
The Cuban ambassador said many countries are unaware of the impact that these sanctions are having on countries' healthcare systems and people's normal day-to-day lives.
As a result of this seminar, we will try to impulse all declaration in all resolution of United Nations to include the request to the United States and the other country and the European country who impose unilateral coercive measure to lifting those measures as the Secretary General of the United Nations requests and the High Commissioner of Human Rights.
In a joint statement, representatives of 38 participating countries said unilateral coercive measures are against international law, human rights and the UN Charter.
Under the current circumstances caused by the coronavirus, they said, sanctions have made targeted countries vulnerable and need to be lifted. Homa Lizki, Vienna.
Azerbaijani forces have moved into the final district given up by Armenia in a peace deal that ended weeks of fighting over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Azerbaijan's defense ministry released a video showing a tank leading a column of trucks into the Lachin district. The trucks were flanked by military vehicles from Russia, which brokered the peace deal. Under the accord, Armenia agreed to hand over Azerbaijan three districts. The deal also saw some 2,000 Russian peacekeepers deployed in Nagorno-Karabakh. The agreement was reached on November 9th and it extended 6 weeks of fighting between Azerbaijan and Armenia over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. The fighting was the deadliest in decades dispute over the region. Since the coronavirus hit France nearly a year ago and with a second lockdown in 6 months, unemployment and poverty are raising dramatically in the European country. Our correspondent Kristen Hunt reports from Paris.
A new kind of the French population is falling into a state of poverty. That's the conclusion of a poll institute Ipsos, the Observatory of Inequalities, and of important humanitarian associations like the Resto du Coeur and Secours Populaire. They sound the alarm. The health crisis caused by the coronavirus is provoking an unprecedented social crisis. A new kind of people stand in line today for clothes and food assistance.
More and more people are coming here, especially since 3 weeks, because it's getting cold. We have started distribution points for women and older people, and we see that more women and older persons are coming. Now we have also more and more young people, young mothers, and students, so there is more diversity in the people coming here.
Rachid Agar is the founder and responsible of this Open Table Humanitarian Association. Since long time, he is heavily invested in aid for people in need.
Those who had small jobs of 2 or 3 hours a day, they sunk. Everybody is at the bottom. We picked up many of them. They were on a tightrope and they tipped over. We see a lot of them.
1 in 3 French persons has now less income than before the COVID crisis. those who still have work fear to lose their job. Mariette was a saleswoman. Her business closed during the first lockdown. Now she depends from the food distribution. She crossed the line.
These people emptied their savings. They consumed the last tin can before coming here to us. At the end, when they had nothing left, they came here and stood in line. We notice people who come here for the first time. The misery today is screaming. We hear it. Hunger is yelling. Before, hunger and the misery were silent and hidden. Today, people are not ashamed anymore because they are in a survival mode.
The number of persons who receive food aid increased with 30% since the COVID crisis. Old people are paying a heavy tribute in matter of health, but young people will suffer more from the economic impact of the COVID crisis. Half of the poor in France is less than 30 years old. Since the beginning of the COVID crisis and the two lockdowns, 1 extra million of French has fallen under the poverty line. That's a total of 10 million of poor people in France. The Bank of France foresees an unemployment rate over 10% for 2021. An increasing number of people are in need for food assistance and blankets, especially now in the freezing cold. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The Limelight.
Pennsylvania's highest court has thrown out a lower court's order that was preventing the state from certifying dozens of contests from the 3rd of November election. In the latest Republican lawsuit attempting to thwart President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the battleground state, the state Supreme Court unanimously threw out the three-day-old order, saying the underlying lawsuit was filed months after the law allowed for challenges to Pennsylvania's year-old mail-in voting law. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian, with the Associated Press contributing to the report. The piece is titled, Pennsylvania Supreme Court Throws Out Republican Bid to Reject 2.5 Million Mail-in Votes. Stay with us for more. Pennsylvania's highest court has thrown out a lower court's order that was preventing the state from certifying dozens of contests from the 3rd of November election. In the latest Republican lawsuit attempting to thwart President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the battleground state, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court unanimously threw out the three-day-old order, saying the underlying lawsuit was filed months after the law allowed for challenges to Pennsylvania's year-old mail-in voting law. Justices also remarked on the lawsuit's staggering demand that an entire election be overturned retroactively. They have failed to allege that even a single mail-in ballot was fraudulently cast or counted, Justice David Wedge wrote in a concurring opinion. The state's Attorney General, Democrat Josh Shapiro, called the court's decision another win for democracy. The week-old lawsuit, led by Pennsylvania's Republican Congressman Mike Kelly, had challenged the state's mail-in voting law as unconstitutional. As a remedy, Mike Kelly and other Republican plaintiffs had sought to either throw out the 2.5 million mail-in ballots submitted under the law, most of them by Democrats, or to wipe out the election results and direct the state's Republican-controlled legislature to pick Pennsylvania's presidential electors. The request for the state's lawmakers to pick Pennsylvania's presidential electors also flies in the face of a nearly century-old state law, which grants the power to pick electors to the state's popular vote, Justice Wedge wrote. Whilst the High Court's two Republicans, joined the five Democrats in opposing those remedies. They split from Democrats in suggesting that the lawsuit's underlying claims that the state's mail-in voting law might violate the Constitution are worth considering. On Wednesday, Commonwealth Court Judge Patricia McCullough, elected as a Republican in 2009, had issued the order to halt certification of any remaining contests, including apparently contests for Congress. A day earlier, Democratic Governor of Pennsylvania Tom Wolf said he had certified Joe Biden as the winner of the presidential election in Pennsylvania. Biden beat President Donald Trump by more than 80,000 votes in Pennsylvania, a state Donald Trump had won back in 2016. Democratic Governor Tom Wolf had appealed Justice McCulloch's decision to the state Supreme Court, saying there was no conceivable justification for it. The defeat followed Friday's decision by a federal appeals court to dismiss a separate challenge to the Pennsylvania result and back a district judge who likened the president's evidence-free and error-strewn lawsuit to Frankenstein's monster. The three-member federal panel confirmed unanimously a lower court's decision last week to rebuff the argument made by Donald Trump's legal team, led by former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, that voting in Pennsylvania was marred by widespread fraud. Free, fair elections are the lifeblood of our democracy. Charges of unfairness are serious, but calling an election unfair does not make it so. Charges require specific allegations, and then they require proof. We have neither here, Judge Stefanos Bibas wrote for the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The judge denounced as breathtaking a Republican request to reverse certification of the vote, adding, "Voters, not lawyers, choose the president. Ballots, not briefs, decide elections. The campaign's claims have no merit whatsoever." The ruling, which was the Trump team's 38th court defeat in election lawsuits nationwide, reaffirmed U.S. District Judge Matthew Brand's earlier view of Giuliani's complaint, delivered after he listened to 5 hours of oral arguments last week. The lawsuit, Judge Matthew Brand said, was like Frankenstein's monster, haphazardly stitched together. Meanwhile, a Donald Trump supporter who donated $2.5 million to help expose and prosecute claims of fraud in the presidential election wants his money back after what he says are disappointing results. Frederick Eshelman, a businessman from North Carolina and a Trump supporter, said he gave the money to True the Vote, a pro-Trump election ethics group in Texas that promised to file lawsuits in 7 swing states, as part of its push to investigate, litigate, and expose suspected illegal balloting and fraud in the 2020 general election. But according to a lawsuit businessman Eshelman filed this week in Houston, Texas, True the Vote dropped its legal actions and discontinued its Validate the Vote 2020 campaign, then refused to return his calls when he demanded an explanation. The founder of Eshelman Ventures, a venture capital company, said he asked regularly and repeatedly for updates, the lawsuit asserts, but that his requests were consistently met with vague responses, platitudes, and empty promises. The lack of success of True the Vote's efforts to challenge the outcome appears to mirror that of President Donald Trump himself, whose team has lost 38 court actions since the 3rd of November presidential election, most recently in Pennsylvania, where the federal appeals court panel blasted Trump's legal team for filing a case with no merit. We'll be right back.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome. This is News Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor, and we're coming to you from the British capital. Now, please stay with us as we delve into the day's top stories and social media talking points. But our top story: the European Union has condemned the assassination of a top Iranian scientist. Brussels says the killing was a criminal act, but the bloc is urging all sides to practice restraint as tensions between Iran and the United States and Israel escalate once more. U.S. President Donald Trump, a staunch ally of Tel Aviv, leaves the White House in just a few weeks, and some say this might be a last-ditch attempt at provoking an escalation with Iran, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
Today, Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was laid to rest. He was assassinated on Friday near the capital, Tehran. Iran has vowed to avenge the killing. On the day of the attack, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif urged the international community, especially the European Union, to abandon its shameful double standard and condemn this, quote, act of state terror. The European Union made its position clear in an official post on its website Saturday. This is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights the EU stands for. The EU is calling for all sides to practice restraint, though, saying this is a sensitive time. Germany has urged all sides not to allow the last weeks of Donald Trump's presidency in the US to obliterate hopes for fresh negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. The United Kingdom, however, has been less inclined to condemn the attack.
Well, look, we are concerned about the situation in Iran and the wider region. We do want to see de-escalation of tensions, and obviously, particularly, we want to try and find a route through on the nuclear dossier. I met with my E3 colleagues, so France and Germany, in Berlin this week. It's a good example, that kind of cooperation, notwithstanding all the Brexit process, keeps going on. We're still waiting to see the full facts, trying to ascertain the full facts of what's happened in Iran. But I would say that we stick to the rule of international humanitarian law, which is very clear against targeting civilians.
Israel's lobby in the UK is strong, and British politicians are very careful not to offend the Zionist regime. The New York Times says Israel was behind the attack, citing an American official and two intelligence sources. Tel Aviv has carried out a number of assassination operations against Iranian nuclear scientists over the past decade, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu mentioned Dr. Fakhrizadeh by name in one of his presentations in 2018.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name.
U.S. President Donald Trump, who withdrew the U.S. from a landmark Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and has imposed new sanctions on Iran since, has only a few weeks left in the White House. There are indications his successor, Joe Biden, may have a different approach to diplomacy in the region and might go as far as rejoining the Iran nuclear deal and lifting some economic sanctions. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Masoud Zajareh from the Islamic Human Rights Commission is with us more for this far-reaching story. Masoud, firstly, what is your reaction to the statements coming out of Europe and Westminster on this terror attack?
Well, unfortunately, it's too late, and I will say even too little. The reality is that, they should condemn the act of terrorism without any sort of any further complication. The fact that they're coming out and saying that they're asking both sides or all sides to show restraint, it's actually a testimony that they know exactly who has committed these acts of crime. And it's because of that they're not going all the way in condemnation. And when it comes to the Britain, it really is outrageous. It's a shambles. That again testifies that this was done by the Israelis, and this is why they are behaving the way they are behaving. It's almost like saying that they're scared that if they actually expose the criminals who committed this, they will be accused of anti-Semitism or something similar to that. This is outrageous.
What is also outrageous, Masoud, is the notion that perhaps Iranian scientists and officials might not even be safe on home territory. Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's compare this with the situation of assassination of opposition in Russia, which took place in Russia itself. And it was a poisoning which never killed the individual. But nevertheless, the international community, and European in particular, were very firm and very aggressive against Russia, even though there wasn't really much evidence to prove this was the fact. Here, I think everybody knows, and the behavior of United States, Britain, and indeed even the rest of the world talking about all sides should calm down and be careful. It actually shows very clearly they know who's done this, and the fact that they're not dealing with it, it gives a message, not just to the Zionists, the State of Israel, but to the rest of the world, that international community is not willing. There's no political will to deal with this. And therefore, from now on, it will be law of the jungle.
Indeed. Masoud Zajareh, as always, thank you very much, sir. And we move to other news now, this time across to France, where three French police officers suspended over the alleged beating of a black music producer will remain in custody as a formal investigation is carried out. This, according to the prosecutor in Paris, Remy Heinz. Now, during the press conference, Mr. Heinz explained that judicial authorities wanted to ensure that the officers in question did not have contact with each other or exert pressure on any witnesses. His statement comes just a week after CCTV footage doing the rounds on social media showing the victims being beaten. The man, known only as Michel, sparked fresh claims of police brutality within the country. President Emmanuel Macron has deemed the video as unacceptable and shameful for France. Richard Sudan, we've gone from claims of state racism in France, the accusations of the same, but this time closer to home. Now, anybody following this program will know that you did a rather impressive package on Friday talking about the proposed deportation flight that will have dozens of people from Black Caribbean backgrounds on it. And we're beginning to understand that this flight is still scheduled to go ahead despite lots of calls for it to be halted.
So we know so far that, as you rightly say, the flight is planned to go ahead on this Wednesday, the 2nd of December, despite a petition online gathering literally hundreds or thousands of signatures. There's been celebrities and even MPs that have been writing to the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary urging this flight not to go ahead, because although the Home Office, the government and the right-wing press are really emphasising the most serious crimes allegedly committed by those on board, human rights lawyers and activists are basically saying they believe that the majority of the 50 or so Jamaicans on board actually haven't committed serious offences. We know that one person believed to be on board actually is believed to have committed a motoring offence, and it's believed actually that many or most on board actually have family ties in the UK or have been in the United Kingdom since they were children. And this of course is off the back of the fact that the government still hasn't implemented the findings of the Windrush inquiry, lessons learned review by Wendy Williams. And the Equalities and Human Rights Commission says that if this flight goes ahead, it does actually breach breaking the law. So it's a very serious situation indeed.
It certainly is, but we know that the British government is not afraid of breaking its own rules when it's politically expedient. What's been the online reaction to this, Richard?
I want to go first to a tweet from Lady Zelly, who says, despite the effects from the Windrush scandal, mass deportations still continue and uphold cruel and racist immigration policies. If black lives really matter to you, then where is your action and outrage? No borders, no person is illegal. And we have a reaction from Femi Fatusen, who says to the UK Home Office, these flights need to be cancelled. Mass deportation is not humane. The Windrush generation should not be made to bear the burden of the government's failures. Cut it out. Hashtag Jamaica50, the hashtag being used in this campaign, Amina.
Of course, Priti Patel there following in the footsteps of her former colleague Savi Javid there, and also Theresa May maintaining this hostile environment. To your next story, Richard.
Well, speaking of hostile environments, another black teenager has been shot dead in the United States in Oregon. 19-year-old Aiden Ellison was shot to death in Oregon by Robert Keegan, who was 47. And this is a story which is gaining traction in the US. What's interesting is all of the mainstream media outlets are basically saying this killing was to do with a dispute over music, but it really begs the question, do people really believe that black men, black boys are shot dead in the United States over music being played too loud? Of course, there's an extremely heightened situation of racism, anti-black racism in the United States at the moment. So this story is gaining traction, Amina, and questions are being asked.
Could you bring us the online reaction? I really want to hear what people are saying about this story, Richard.
Well, on that very point, I mean, you're not the only person to make the connection with Jordan Davis. Anchor podcaster Gregory Vale says, this is what happened to that Jordan kid during Obama's administration. Jordan Davis, who was 17, was shot in 2012 in Jacksonville in Florida, where we know racism is rife in a similar case. And we also have a reaction from SS Mastering, who says, if it's in Oregon, you can bet your last dollar that it's a 99% racially motivated case, as the state is home to skinheads and white supremacist groups. It was also illegal for black people to even live there at one time, not too long ago, and their ways of hatred have not changed. And just to contrast what the police chief in Oregon said in charge of the case, Amina, with the newspaper headlines, the police chief said, I understand that there are legitimate tensions surrounding matters of violence against people of color in the United States, and this situation speaks directly to that.
Right, we'll leave it there. We'll, of course, be following not just this particular story, but others. Thank you very much, Richard Sudan. Now, if you've only been consuming your news from mainstream sources, first of all, naughty, naughty, but you might be forgiven for thinking that the Labour Party dodged a bullet when they turfed Jeremy Corbyn as their leader, because so mired was his name with claims of rampant anti-Semitism. And on today of all days, today's International Day of Solidarity with Palestine, Robert Carter goes digging for the evidence that the Labour leader was an anti-Semite.
The UK Labour Party has once again descended into a civil war, with the left wing of the party rebelling against the current leader of Labour, Sir Keir Starmer, over his role in penalising his predecessor, socialist Jeremy Corbyn. This entire war between the left and right camps of the party has by and large centred around one key question: is Jeremy Corbyn an anti-Semite? Many of the accusations against Corbyn relate to his past views and associations before he became leader, as well as his handling of allegations within the party after his election to the top post. These include criticism of Israeli oppression of the Palestinians and hosting or attending events with other outspoken critics of Israel, including a meeting where he shared a platform with a Holocaust survivor, an anti-Zionist political activist who compared Israeli actions in Gaza to elements of the Holocaust. In 2010, Corbyn did apologise for this event, stating,
"In the past, in pursuit of justice for the Palestinian people and peace in Israel and Palestine, I have on occasion appeared on platforms with people whose views I completely reject. I apologise for the concerns and anxiety that this has caused."
However, despite Corbyn's attempts to crack down on anti-Semitism, the media jumped on the chance to place full blame on Corbyn's shoulders in future interviews.
"Against the abuse they receive on the streets, on the trains, or in any other form of life."
Try one more time.
No, hang on a minute, Andrew. Wait a minute. I and our party.
No, just say sorry.
Can I say something?
Well,
our party.
I want you to say sorry.
And our party and me.
Yeah.
Do not accept anti-Semitism in any form.
So are you sorry for
obviously
anything that's happened?
Corbyn supporters have rebuked many of the criticisms against him, citing Corbyn's decades-long support for anti-racism struggles, including the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, the left-wing efforts against British racism, and the Palestinian fight against Israeli apartheid.
"Our party is united in condemning the shooting of hundreds of unarmed demonstrators in Gaza by Israeli forces, and the passing of Israel's discriminatory nation-state law. The continuing occupation, the expansion of illegal settlements, and the imprisonment of Palestinian children are an outrage."
Also, by some astonishing coincidence, many of Corbyn's biggest critics are themselves outspoken supporters of Israel, including many Labour MPs such as Keir Starmer himself.
"I don't describe myself as a Zionist, but I understand and I sympathise and I support Zionism."
Now, despite all of the accusations, Corbyn has never been charged with anti-Semitism and has never been proven to have said anything anti-Semitic himself, yet the label has stuck. This is despite the fact that Corbyn boasts many Jewish supporters who have rubbished the many claims against him.
"I'm Jewish, my whole family's Jewish. I can tell you that we're not scared. Corbyn is not an anti-Semite. The right-wing press takes things out of context, puts them in headlines."
"Is a manipulation by an Israeli propaganda outfit, by the right-wing of the party, of the Labour Party, and goodness knows who else."
"Everybody makes mistakes, and I think he's made mistakes. But he hasn't become an anti-Semite. He doesn't support anti-Semitism. He loathes it, as every right-thinking person does."
Also, what rarely gets mentioned is Corbyn's long history of helping Jewish causes before becoming leader of the party, including his signing of numerous early-day motions condemning anti-Semitism, his 1987 campaign to reverse Islington Council's decision to destroy a Jewish cemetery, and in 2010 called on the UK government to facilitate the settlement of Yemeni Jews to Britain. So with all that said, I leave you with this question. If it's true that Corbyn is and always has been a rabid anti-Semite, then why is it proven harder than expected to maintain his suspension from the party?
Robert Carter there, cutting to the chase. Into Italy we go now, where at least three people have been killed by flooding on the island of Sardinia. This according to authorities in the local media. In Biti, a town in the province of Nuoro, streets were turned into rivers of mud, which covered cars and flooded cellars. A 55-year-old farmer was killed by a landslide, and a 90-year-old man died at home, according to the Italian news agency ANSA. Emergency services are still searching for the body of a woman in her 90s, amongst others. Talks between the European Union and the United Kingdom have resumed over the weekend as both sides continue to push on in efforts to strike a trade deal before the end of the year. The EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, is currently in London as negotiations are set to go down to the wire. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said the UK will prosper with or without a deal, but the economic harm and disruption will be inevitable. Competition rules and fishing rights continue to be areas of disagreement between Brussels and London. Any deal between the two sides will need to be ratified by Parliament before December the 31st. It seems Robert Inlakesh, Donald Trump, is sending his very best people to go sort out the issues in the Middle East. Alas, it turns out this list is helmed by the man married to his daughter. Jared Kushner, explain.
Well, Jared Kushner, a man who seems to affect everything and turn it into garbage that he touches in terms of diplomacy, who's been an absolute failure when it comes to diplomacy, is headed off to Qatar to try and host talks between Saudi Arabia and Qatar to try and ease this ongoing feud that's been going on since really 2017. It's been going on for 3 years, and it seems like Saudi Arabia does not want to really engage meaningfully with Qatar. But if this was able to be pulled off, this would mean that Saudi Arabia would have to effectively isolate the United Arab Emirates, who have been on a campaign to isolate and really destroy the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood inside of the Middle East. On top of this as well, Qatar would have to perhaps pull away from Iran further, isolate itself from Iran, take a more aggressive stance towards Iran. That's perhaps what we would see if the two came together. And also on top of this, we saw that in 2017, Qatar was actually forced by Saudi Arabia to stop supporting Hamas for a while. And what happened there is because of a lack of funding going to the Gaza Strip, Hamas is the elected government in Gaza, people were suffering greatly. So it really doesn't look like a positive thing. And it's a good job such a terrible statesperson is there.
All right. Very quick on the tweets for me, Rob.
The first one we have here says, Jared Kushner and his team are hoping to use their dwindling political leverage to advance issues of U.S. interest, with a particular focus on resolving the three-year-old rift between Qatar and its Persian Gulf neighbors. We got another one here as well from a user called Ahmed, who says, Jared Kushner is completely useless as a statesperson. Kushner being in power shows how stupid Trump is. How could you let someone so incompetent do his job? If Trump wants war against Iran, he will lose badly with this team behind him.
All right, quick story there in the United States with the president-elect's woke team.
Well, many people have pointed to this and said this is basically like having, you know, a transgender slave owner running a slave plantation. You know, you're putting this trendy face on a massive war machine which is going around the world and massacring innocent civilians. And there's no real point in having so many women and so many people of color in government if they don't represent the majority views of their communities, their given communities, if you're having such a diverse group of people in there. If they're all carbon copies of Condoleezza Rice, what's the why not just have a whole bunch of old white men in there if all of them think like old white men who are taking money from corporations and pushing for all the lobby interests? You know, placing in people who just look a certain way doesn't do anything. We saw that Barack Obama, being the first black president, did little to nothing for African Americans. And that should have been an issue that he was at least strong on, but he wasn't. He lied about everything from creating peace with the Palestinians to withdrawing from Iraq, which he didn't do, just like Trump hasn't done.
Indeed, didn't close Guantanamo either, as I recall. Reactions online to this one, Rob?
The first one is we have here is from Rania Khalik, who is a journalist in the United States. She says, Biden putting women in charge of U.S. imperialism is not feminism. It's just putting a female face on the same cruel and destructive policies that impoverish and kill people around the world. We have another one here as well from a Twitter user called Rob, who says, the hollowness of bourgeoisie identity politics harnessed to the war machine.
Right, somebody did their political science degree with that tweet. Robert Inlakesh, we'll leave it there. Thank you so very much. And of course, thank you for staying the course with us.
The incoming U.S. administration is facing a major test of transparency and ethics after the New York Times reported on Saturday, November 28, that three former government officials tapped to run Joe Biden's national security team have been stakeholders at a private equity firm which is promising investors big profits off government business because of its ties to those officials. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by the staff of Common Dreams website, published under the heading The Revolving Door. Biden's national security nominees want back in after cashing out of government service. Here's the details of this article.